Well, thanks for joining another Tennis Takeaway podcast. And I'm delighted to say that our special guest this week, a warm welcome to him, is George Belshaw, who writes a lot about tennis for Metro UK. A busy weekend, a busy week again in the Asian swing, George. And I guess we have to start with Novak Djokovic. I mean, what a performance to come back from injury and go all the way through and see off John Millman in the final for his fourth title of the year.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty flawless all week, to be honest. He was in one of those moods where his serve was just working kind of metronomically all week. I thought he played quite aggressively in a lot of the matches. I'm not sure if that was a result of being a bit, in a weird way, kind of in a weird roundabout way, a bit cautious of the shoulder in the terms he didn't want to be on court for too long. He had quite a lot of very sharp matches. You know, sometimes you watch Djokovic play and you think he's just kind of teasing his prey for a few hours, just wearing them down, and then thinks I'll strike. But I thought he was a lot more to the point at points this week, particularly against Pui and again today against John Millman, who's a guy who's capable of making things very long and uncomfortable. Yeah, it was pretty excellent. And, you know, for Djokovic, okay, this wasn't the strongest field. That has to be said. You know, I think the second highest ranked player was Borna Coric, who's around 13 or 14. You know, probably a little bit stronger over in Beijing. But, you know, obviously he's got the mitigating factor of this shoulder injury he was coming back from. So it's hard to take too many negatives for him, particularly when you consider this is the same site where the Rio Olympics will be next year, which is one of his biggest goals. So
yeah, hopefully it'll be the Tokyo Olympics, not the Rio ones, but I know what you mean.
Oh, yes. No, I beg your pardon. You can tell it's been a long day.
It has indeed. Bazza, you kept a close eye on things, obviously, all week, commentating on the tournament. What was your assessment of Novak and that shoulder?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with George. I thought Djokovic was excellent. And I think we've seen it many times, haven't we, how almost unbeatable Djokovic can be at this time of the year. He normally plays Beijing and he's won all 29 matches in Beijing. He decided to change it up this year with what George was saying, Tokyo Olympics. And also a little surprising because his old clothing company, Uniqlo, obviously is Japanese. So the fact that he never played in Tokyo before. But I think, yeah, change it up. Probably got a good fat guarantee as well. That always helps. But I think in terms of his mindset, he always plays with a little bit more freedom, I think, at this time of the year. I mean, the conditions are obviously tailor-made for him. But he's got a point to prove. He's trying to chase something. He's trying to hunt down Rafa. And the 500 points he got from this week will help. Nadal's not playing next week in Shanghai. So the real possibility, the next time both are in the same tournament, which would be Paris, Djokovic might have closed the gap to within 500 points. So I think, you know, an excellent week from Djokovic. It really wouldn't surprise me if he goes from now until the end of the year undefeated. I was going to ask George, any sign in the oxygen chamber, George, in Tokyo, or is that just strictly for New York?
I mean, it sounds like it goes everywhere with him these days, doesn't it? I'm sure what he does at Wimbledon, he goes to a little centre. I'm trying to remember exactly where it is. I think it's kind of Mayfair area. So he kind of finds one within the city. So I'm not sure if he's been doing the same in Tokyo. But it's a pretty handy device. I don't know if you've ever had a go with it, but it does certainly improve your breathing and hemoglobin levels. So it's certainly served him well over
in
the years.
In terms of his accuracy, I mean, it's just unerring how great that has become. And John Millman said, I hope everybody realizes how great this guy is if they don't already. I mean, he was on the receiving end today and he didn't play badly himself, did he? He's had an excellent week to come through all the way from qualifying. But it's just another level that you face when, if you're in his position facing Djokovic, because he has taken this sport to a level perhaps of consistency of play, of accuracy, Bazza, that we've never seen before.
Yeah, I'm always very quick to defend Djokovic on that. And I think whenever there's a real excitement and a real energy whenever Nadal and Federer play, because I think you watch those guys and you sort of leave a match of 2 hours or 3 hours and there's moments that are just jaw-dropping. With Djokovic, and I think for Novak, he's played the best tennis I've ever seen in the men's game. I mean, the level he's able to achieve at his best can beat Nadal and Federer on every surface, except, of course, Rafa on the clay. But I think it's just, it's simplistic brilliance from Djokovic. You know, he is at times just a metronome. It's just relentless, point after point after point. And I think sometimes that may be people who involved in the sport day in, day out can appreciate it. But maybe the casual fan can't. Maybe at times they don't really appreciate that the absolute brilliance that it is, that he's able to do it point in, point out.
Well, of course, the other big gathering of the past week was in the Chinese capital in Beijing. And when you think of Djokovic, George, who seems to carry that mantle of world number one so well and can turn up again after injury and do what he does. When you look at the women's game, obviously, there are a number of them jockeying for that number one position, but they seem to find it perhaps harder when they are number one to carry on maintaining that level rather than when they are the ones challenging for it. And I think we saw that, did we not, in Osaka's performance overall today against Ash Barty?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, her rise last year was pretty meteoric. Obviously, winning two Grand Slams back to back is no mean feat at any point in your career, but to do it for the first two, I thought was pretty outstanding. And for me, what's become really clear about Osaka's game is, and where I think this big dip came, is that, you know, she's the, for me, the world number one hardcore player, along with Andreescu. I see those two as the kind of best two on that surface.
Yes.
But she's maybe just struggles a bit on the other surfaces for the time being. And I've no doubt she'll improve drastically there. But I think it knocked her confidence a little bit when she was kind of going through this, first of all, adapting to being world number one, also adapting to the coaching change, you know, losing Sasha Bajin. You know, I felt her confidence when she had that knee problem as well. So a few things were kind of going against her. But it's so often the case, as you were saying, in the women's game, when the pressure of that number one ranking's not hanging over you, you're allowed to kind of find your best tennis. And she's been excellent the last 2 weeks, and not necessarily playing flawless tennis like Djokovic has, but kind of mentally the way she was coming back. You know, she came back against Andreescu, obviously again today in the final against Ash Barty, you know, down a set and a break. You know, oh, sorry, she wasn't down a set and a break today, but she was against Andreescu. You know, that fighting spirit that we saw in Australia, which in similar terms, it wasn't the perfect slam. There were times where she was in big trouble and she just found a way kind of out of that trouble, and it's good to see that side of things back for her, because she is such a brilliant player and someone we hope will not necessarily dominate the sport but have great rivalries with other youngsters like Andreescu. And I think that's really what the women's game is lacking right now, is just a couple of them to really just step above the parapet and start to kind of dominate, create these great rivalries, because that's really where you sell them as big names.
Absolutely that. And certainly in terms of their age, they are still all very young. I thought it was interesting that Osaka's dad's influence at the end of that first set, and just sort of saying to her that, you know, if she could keep herself calm, she had problems to solve on the court, she would do that if she remained calm or found a calmness, because she was obviously somewhat uptight in that first set. And that proved to be. So that was very knowing sort of reference from her father to help her through that. But in terms of rivalries, as you say, team against Tsitsipas, that's one that we're going to see plenty more of. And if it's anything like today's match in Beijing, their final, it'll be awesome, won't it? I've never seen team come so much to the net, Bazza.
Yeah, I mean, he described it as one of the best matches in his life, which is saying something when you have to factor in that team has beaten Nadal on the clay. He's beaten Djokovic at the French Open. I mean, he's coming of age. He's won as many titles this year on the hard that he has on his favourite surface. Of course, winning Indian Wells, I think, was a huge, huge hurdle to overcome for him in terms of his belief. And I've always thought, Barry and George, that Dominic could become a great hardcore player. I think it was just a matter of time getting the right balance. And, you know, the coaching change that he made at the beginning of the year has seemed to have helped. And I'm also pleased for him as well, because the North American summer was tough on him. I still think he got his schedule wrong. I still think a player of his standing shouldn't be playing two clay court tournaments before the North American swing of Canada, Cincy, and US Open. You understand why. I mean, obviously, he wants to play his home tournament. But, you know, when you're top five, top six, and you've made the final of a major, I think you've got to be a little bit smarter with your schedule. He got ill in Cincinnati. Anytime you're undercooked going to New York, it will always... He'll always pay for it. But I think he's to win here in Beijing and beating the field as well. I mean, it was a very strong tournament. Khachanov and Zverev were the other two players that made the semifinals. I mean, that gives us a glimpse, doesn't it, guys, for the future. I think we will be seeing a lot of those guys in the last four of a lot of tournaments from now on in.
Sure, hope so. Obviously, another figure who played a significant role this week because he got further than he has so far elsewhere on his return to singles is Andy Murray. And George, you must have to spend, you know, many hours of your days focusing not only on him, but obviously on the Brits as well. But in terms of where he is now, how would you assess things?
I mean, I think first and foremost, we have to just say what an unbelievably positive couple of weeks it's been in China for him so far. I mean, I think everyone kind of wants this answer, where's Andy Murray going to be in a year's time? But if we're looking back where he's come from in a month's time or even a couple of weeks' time, it's a completely different player. And that's not to say it was perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I think, you know, if you look at that match with Cam Norrie, particularly when he was playing 2 days in a row, he was really flagging in that. And of course, he played 5 hours of tennis across 2 days. So it was pretty tough. But had he had to play team the day after that, which could easily have been the case in these kind of smaller tournaments where you're playing every single day, he was kind of fortunate to get a bit of a scheduling break. But, you know, regardless of that, to then go out and play a very good match against Dominic Thiem. I thought Thiem was clearly the better player, but it showed Murray's still able to compete with these guys, still chip away. And it's not a bad look for him to lose to Alex de Minaur, who won the title the week before in Zhuhai, and then to lose to Dominic Thiem, who's gone on to win the title there. So that's always, if you're going to lose to anyone, you may as well lose to the eventual champion. So it's not too bad a look for him at the minute.
And no, being a writer, George, is there still as much intrigue? Do the readers still want to hear as much about Murray as they did 2 years ago when he was world number one?
I mean, for us, we've noticed quite a big change even in this month. I think, you know, when he was kind of running around on one leg last year, people were a bit kind of like, oh no, this is kind of hard to watch, it's a bit sad. And then it obviously crescendoed at the Australian Open, where you're all thinking it's over and everyone's, you know, kind of writing obituaries for this great athlete. And then I think people are a little bit more tentative about this comeback, having seen what happened the year before. You know, is he actually going to come back, or is it just kind of dragging out the end or whatever? Will he play one kind of final send off at Wimbledon? But I do sense there's been a genuine shift in interest in the last couple of weeks, particularly this week, actually, in Beijing. You know, that win over Berrettini, suddenly people were like, oh, crikey, he's beating someone who's been the eighth best player in 2019. You know, a week before, Murray was saying he felt he was playing around top 60 or 70 level. It felt to me this week he was a lot closer to top 30. And he's saying he's not physically going to be ready until Australia. So, you know, the tennis has never been the issue for Andy. And I think people are starting to believe that physically he can get back to a level where he can be top 20, top 10. And from there, who knows, you know, with Federer and Nadal going out the picture, Djokovic has obviously just had this shoulder thing at the US Open. So it's not like he's as completely invincible as ever. I mean, he's still obviously far and away the best, but I just mean he could get an injury or whatever. It just feels like the field's a little bit smaller. Andy looks in ridiculously good shape, you know, aside from this hip he's recovering from. You know, he's never looked fitter, I don't think, kind of muscularly. So I think there's a lot of positivity. A lot of people are genuinely quite excited. And if he has another decent run in Shanghai next week, which I think there's every chance he could win a couple of matches again, having looked at the draw, I think the wave of excitement will continue.
And does your paper, does your editor, you know, with all that you write both in the paper and online, do they see this as well? Are they pushing you to do more and more about him, or is it a hard sell for you to them?
I think, you know, Murray's obviously always caused a lot of interest. I mean, we do quite a lot of wider stuff in tennis. You know, I want to cover it as much as we can and make it as wide reaching, not just entirely Brit focused. Yeah, Murray's still a massive selling point for here. And, you know, it's just, it would be nice to have maybe one last season where we have the big four all completely healthy, firing. I think that would be a kind of nice swan song for them all to go out on a high. I think people are interested. I mean, it's always a battle in terms of dragging full interest from different places. But yeah, I think people do care about Andy.
George, if Murray is your number one selling point, is Kyrgios number two?
I mean, he's certainly up there, isn't he? I think it's remarkable how much people, and when I say people, I mean people who aren't involved in tennis. And that's always what I gauge how interested people are at a certain time of year. It's nothing to do with who I normally talk to on a day-to-day basis, but it's those, you know, general sports fans who drop me a text, or someone who's completely uninterested in sport, you know, sending me an email or a message or whatever. And typically it is about Kyrgios. I think he's just got this ability to kind of transcend tennis, not always, of course, in the right way. I'm sure some of the traditionalists will argue, but, you know, whether he's smashing a racket, calling an umpire a potato, you know, people do just find that interesting. And sometimes it can be a bit of a, it's so bad you just can't take your eyes off it. You know, I sat courtside about one row from the front for him at Queens against Ogier Aliassim. And honestly, you're just sat there. The tennis is secondary. You're just listening to this guy have a monologue. And it's kind of, it is so engaging. You don't know what to do. You could write, you know, 100 online articles off one set of all the stuff he gets up to. You know, I remember him kind of just getting annoyed with a photographer for taking a picture of him blowing his nose into a towel, and then he lobs his snotty towel at a photographer, and you're just like, what on earth is this guy going up to? His focus just goes all around the court, and anything can kind of set him off at any moment. I think that just makes him such an engaging watch, and I mean this in the nicest way possible about tennis, but sometimes there are a lot of matches where, particularly at slams, you can kind of phase out of it. You can see where the rhythms are going. You know, and of course it's sport and can always change suddenly, but there are a lot of matches where you just think where it's, you can see how this is going, see where this is panning out. Djokovic is going to win this in straight sets. It's going to be very easy and whatever. But with Kyrgios, there's just no such thing. And I think that makes him just such a big draw that win or lose, you know, something's going to happen. And whether it's the electric tennis he can produce or just the kind of crazy antics that he unfortunately produces as often as the electric tennis, that just makes him so watchable and I actually think lovable for people who aren't in tennis. They really do kind of take to him. So, yeah, a lot of interest in him. Certainly the biggest guy outside the big four and Serena.
It was a long time coming, but what's your thoughts on the 16-week suspended ban?
I mean, it's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like he's just taking his own little suspension anyway, because he's kind of conveniently got saying he's got an injury and going back to Australia for a few months. So
yeah, the day that we heard the announcement from the ATP.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that I think it's a good idea for him not to head out to the Asian Swing, because that is traditionally somewhere where things go very badly, and you know, in the sense where you're struggling to defend him for his kind of antics. I mean, obviously it was quite a slow decision. I know a lot of people within the game have kind of on the administratorial side have kind of defended why it took so long. But it did feel a little bit like they were just skipping the Laver Cup, even though he couldn't have been banned for the Laver Cup under these questionable ATP rules about whether it is a proper tour event or not. I mean, I don't really understand how it couldn't have been sanctioned for that, but that's a conversation for another day. I just struggle to see how he's not going to trigger this ban, though, at some point. I mean, it's like a 6-month grace period, isn't it? And, you know, I just would be quite surprised if he didn't blow up at least once and say, I think, you know, the one that really sticks out is this verbal abuse towards an official. I mean, every Kyrgios match I've watched, in some form, there's been some verbal abuse, you know, some worse than others. But I do find it quite hard to see that he'll be 6 months of perfection. I hope it, you know, we don't want to completely nullify this character as well. I think that is, you know, as I'm trying to say before about him being a big draw, it is difficult for the ATP in one regard to kind of bite off the hand that feeds you in many ways, which doesn't excuse a lot of his behavior, but he is obviously a big draw. He knows he's a big draw. My big concern for him is, you know, when he was banned for that incident in Shanghai a few years ago, he was given that kind of therapy alongside, and there did seem to be a willingness to change from his part. And it did seem like there was a little bit of a difference, even if it didn't last that long. I'm not so sure that willingness is there this time. I think he's a bit more just like, I don't really care what you think. You need me as much as I need you. That sort of nonsense. But if he does get a ban and does have to spend a long time away from the tour, I think that might be good for him in the long run. I think he likes to pretend he doesn't care, but he clearly does deep down, I think. And if you take him out of the sport and stop him playing, perhaps in the long run, it'll be the best thing that ever happens to him. But, you know, I'm tired of making predictions about what he's up to next, because I just don't think anyone really knows.
I think, to be fair to the ATP in terms of what they're trying to do, it's sort of a carrot and stick approach, isn't it? So they're trying to sort of say, look, if you adhere to what we're saying, and we're going to help you with the sort of mental side of it, you know, make sure that you have some support there, then as long as you behave yourself, then okay. And I think that that is the way they've got to go. Obviously, if he transgresses now, they're going to have to throw the book at him in terms of what they've said they will do should he breach any of those regulations. But talking of officialdom, obviously a lot could have changed by the time he does come back and play. The ATP, what is your understanding, George, of where things now stand? Because it's all gone rather quiet. We were expecting perhaps more out of the US Open, the meeting then, the board members, whether Chris Kermode is going to still continue in some role or other. What do you understand is the latest there?
Yeah, I mean, as I kind of first reported when Chris was being made to step down or not renew his contract or whatever, you know, I thought we'd be in a case where this doesn't get solved properly for 18 months to a year. The last thing I'd really heard on it is that there are a few names being put forward. Mark Leschly, I think it is, who runs the that alternate ranking system that's name is evading me at the moment.
The UTR,
that's the one. Yeah. You know, he was someone who the Djokovic camp were fans of. At least that is the word on the street. But, you know, the tournaments are very wary to be agreeing to anyone that the players are huge fans of, because obviously they don't want to get in a situation where, you know, clearly this faction has enough power on the board to get them to all vote with them. They've got six of them now in the council who are going to recommend to the board, even with Federer and Nadal hopefully in there to kind of cool things down, I suppose, or kind of give a voice of reason on some of the more kind of aggressive demands. You know, they do still have a majority in that player council at the minute to pass through what they see fit to a degree. And if they elect the wrong, or, you know, as the players would see it, the right guy at the top, he might side with the players a bit more to the tournament's detriment. So I think they're a little bit anxious about passing someone through. So I don't think anything is close. I know there have been a few people come and go. I won't name all the names, because I'm not sure they've all kind of hit the public sphere. But you know, there's a lot. You hear a lot of names coming in and out, saying they've been for interviews that didn't go well, didn't go in the right direction. So basically, I think they're down to three or four candidates again at the minute. But the biggest problem is getting it approved by both the players' side and the tournament side. And I just don't see that deadlock being broken anytime soon, particularly with the kind of lobbying that's going on with, you know, Pospisil and his letter, that all the players are kind of signing at the Grand Slams and stuff. You know, it is kind of a bit of a tense time. I think everyone's a little bit wary of showing their hand at the moment. So I'm not expecting masses of progress. Chris is expected to go and seems happy enough that he won't be doing something. He seems, you know, like he's got plans to move on. So I don't see any situation where he's staying on for an extra year, as has been kind of mooted in the past. I think that ship's probably sailed now. But yeah, I think not much progress, basically.
Is Gimelstob still lurking in the background?
There will come a point where he wants to come back. Arguably the most interesting thing politically on that side of the thing is that, of course, Weller Evans is only in temporarily until the end of the year, so that there's that kind of vote to happen again. And there was a school of thought back in the summer that the plan was get Weller in for these 6 months, and then, you know, the storm will have died down enough for Justin to kind of waltz back in. I mean, I think I personally think that would be far too soon. I like to think I'm not the only one who would kick up for fuss is probably the wrong word, but challenge that if that were to happen. But there's no obvious cry from Gimelstob at the minute. I think he rightly, whether you like the guy or not, I think everyone could do with a step back from this whole thing, his name. And I'm not saying he should never come back to the sport. He does have a lot of things on his rap sheet that I don't overly approve of. But, if he does change, get his life in order, sort out his anger and aggression issues and whatever, then, of course, we're not here to be permanent judge and jury and whatever. But I do think it would be a bit too soon for him to just walk back into that role. So I hope that doesn't happen. And I've not heard anything suggesting it will any more recently than kind of early summer. So if he is planning it, it's going to be quite a late run, I think.
So bearing in mind what you've said about Chris, and it seems like he's going to move on to other things, we're going to head into 2020 with kind of this situation fairly quiet and unresolved.
Yeah, and I think, this can, of course, all change in the next couple of weeks if they find this candidate who works for both sides or whatever. But I just, at the minute, I don't think that will be happening. And this has happened quite a few times in the past, I understand, before I was kind of really heavily involved in covering it. But I think like VPs quite often just step in and kind of are acting chairman. But of course, in that sort of situation, the bigger problem is that they're very reluctant to vote anything through because they are just an acting president. So it's kind of a bit pointless for everyone, and I think that is the danger with this whole thing, that we end up just sat around for a whole year with no one making a decision, which ultimately doesn't suit the players, who clearly feel they deserve a lot more, and it doesn't suit the tournaments, who want to be passing their own changes or whatever. So in fact it probably suits the tournament slightly more, in the sense that it's unlikely there'd be any big prize money increases without a kind of permanent president in there. But it just doesn't make the whole situation seem very friendly or whatever. I think there's just a little bit of anxiety on both sides at the minute. But I hope I'm wrong, and I hope they do kind of resolve it. There's still a couple of months left to the end of the year, and as you guys well know, these things can change quite quickly. But at the minute, as I understand, there's not masses of progress.
Indeed. Meanwhile, of course, the ITF, they have had a big vote, and David Haggerty has been re-elected for another four-year term as their president, and he had a majority of over 60% of the vote. So an emphatic win for him. It obviously strengthens his position going forward. But what's your sense of how the sport's kind of reacting to that, the players in particular? What do you feel they think of that decision? Because obviously he's had huge support from many associations to win that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the players just aren't very happy with the ITF full stop, and understandably, really. I mean, when you look at what's happened with that World Tennis Tour last year, there's been no kind of accountability for that. They were almost kind of praising themselves for going back to the old system and just kind of chucking money away in the process. I mean, it was a bit of a farce, really, all of that. And, I don't think there was any particularly great plan in Dave Haggerty's manifesto to kind of tackle that. And I think a lot of people still think the kind of tour in the lower ranks still isn't fit for purpose and still does need to be sorted. But whether they're actually going to risk trying to do anything again, given how disastrous that was in the first place, remains to be seen.
Bazza, you obviously spoke to Dave Miley early in the year. We had him on the podcast with your interview. Have you spoken to him since the vote was taken?
No, I haven't. I sort of wanted to let him get over it. I know he'll be very disappointed, and in time I will speak to him, because I think he was very positive. I know, George, you've spoken to him, and I think he felt that he had a great chance. When I saw him at the French, when I saw him at Wimbledon, spoke to him on both those occasions about what he thought could happen. He was positive, and he's been on this relentless surge, traveling around the world to try and get the votes from the various federations. But I guess, that the federations wanted to stick with Haggerty for another term.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke a little bit to Dave kind of since the result, and I spoke to him in the kind of week leading up to the election, it was the same kind of thing that Barry said there. You know, it was, he obviously thought he had a great chance. And to be honest, a lot of our conversation, I was like, you know, everyone thinks Haggerty's going to win this by a landslide. Why are you so confident? You know, a lot of people are kind of calling you crazy. And it's like, you know, he genuinely believed, he thought his message could come across. But ultimately, I think politically, it's just a very different game, this sort of thing. And the incumbent does always have a lot more power. You know, there's a lot further reach. And the fact he's from the US as well makes him a powerful guy in general. You know, there was that letter from the US Olympics committee that went out to a lot of the smaller nations. You know, that sort of thing is something that Dave Miley didn't have in terms of backing or whatever resources. I've got no personal problem with Haggerty particularly. I think there have been a lot of mistakes made this year, and a lot of, or not this year, this past 4 years. Davis Cup, I think, is a bone of contention. I'm probably in the camp now that we should get behind it and try and make it work. You know, I think there's been a lot of noise around that, and you know, I wasn't particularly happy with Zverev's kind of move to go and play exhibitions on the other side of the world with Federer. I thought that was in pretty, you know, I just don't think that's a great look when you've got this big competition, you're trying to get off the ground again, trying to get everyone excited. You know, for him to then just go around the world and play a couple of exhibitions, that doesn't really sit right with me. But just no one's pulling in the same direction in tennis, are they? I mean, that is where this all comes down to. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, there are these factions that are good, these are factions that are bad. I do think, on the whole, most people have good intentions for their sides or whatever, but just very few can see the big picture, the compromise ideas, you know, where tennis is, where it's going, the dangers it could be in when all these big stars drop off. You know, it could be a fairly difficult transition for tennis if some of these guys don't make the step up, particularly in the men's side. You know, I think there are a lot of good players coming through, but it might be the case that for a couple of years tennis slips down the pecking order in a lot of countries or whatever. So I just think it's very, very difficult to get these things right, and Haggerty one way or another needs to get a lot more things right than he has done in this previous 4 years. And I think the LTA, you know, I thought their message was quite disappointing, really. You know, they've basically said, look, we're going to back you, even though we think the ITF is going in a horrible direction, or whatever the exact quote was. And I just thought, you know, why on earth are you not saying that 3 or 4 months ago, getting this guy to kind of buck up his ideas earlier, calling him out while he's in the position of power, rather than kind of sheepishly voting for someone who you think is taking the ITF in the wrong direction, and then claiming you're going to hold them to account when you've been completely unable to do that for the past 4 years, and they don't listen to any of your requests anyway. So, you know, I just thought that whole thing, the LTA board decision, it just seems to me like a lot of them don't know what's going on in tennis, and they don't really tap into the feeling in British tennis that, you know, there are a lot of lower ranked players who are really, really let down by this world tour. You know, really upset. Obviously, Haggerty's also gone against the LTA's kind of the way they wanted to go for the Davis Cup, etc. So, just it doesn't really seem like we're necessarily thinking everything through we do. But I hope, just for tennis's sake, that Haggerty does get things right. And I think there's no need to hold a personal grudge against him. If he can sort things out for the ITF, then that'll be good for everyone. But I'm just a little bit sceptical at the minute, given the past 4 years.
Just a couple of things. I mean, firstly, in terms of the main board for the LTA, this was one of my big issues when I was on council and part of the Tennis Performance Committee a few years ago, was no one on the main board actually knows anything about professional tennis. I mean, there's a lot of good heads and very smart people, but they don't actually know professional tennis. So they are being given advice by various people who maybe have their own vested interests. And secondly, George, what do you make of the Martin Corrie situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably tells you all you need to know about what I think about it. I mean, it's just bonkers, isn't it, really? There's this historic case of abuse, and it, you know, he was nothing actually to do with the case itself, but he was part of an investigatory team in, I think it's Hertfordshire, and around 2004, 2005. And ultimately the conclusion came that, you know, this investigation failed to act suitably or, you know, follow proper guidelines or whatever. So yes, he ultimately, I think what's happened in terms of this, him stepping down as LTA president, is they've just struck a bit of a deal, being like, look, you know, you step down from this role and we won't kick you off the ITF board. And, you know, I spoke to the LTA on the day, or a spokesperson from the LTA about this on the day when it was kind of coming out and they were releasing all these quotes. And, you know, it was just, they basically said, look, Corey, the external investigators who've been looking at this case have said, we're all able to kind of draw a line in the sand under it, and that Corey's got all this experience on the ITF board that it, you know, it makes sense for him to kind of carry on and do it. But it's just not a great look, is it, really? I mean, again, it's kind of, it's in a similar kind of breath to, we're talking about Gimelstob before, you know. I'm not saying Martin Corey should never be part of the game again, but, you know, for him literally just on the same day for it to be announced he's resigning as president and to then be being put forward as Britain's candidate for the ITF board just seems utterly bonkers to me, and I'm sure I'm not alone on that. But whatever, I suppose it's happened now, and here we are in another state of bizarre tennis.
And that's just tennis politics. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, guys, let's bring it back finally perhaps to the players. Just a quick word before we talk maybe Shanghai to finish, but just a quick word about Carl Edmund and Dan Evans, because obviously they've had very differing kind of seasons, George, and yet both of them now changing their coaching setup.
Yeah, so the, you know, obviously Dan split with David Felgate in the US hard court summer. I think that in itself was quite an interesting move, but from Dan's perspective, I think it was more of a sign that he feels he can go to another level. And like, obviously Dave did some great stuff for Dan over the last year, and a lot of people probably wouldn't have been willing to take a chance on Dan in many ways after what happened. It kind of looked like he was throwing his career down the toilet again, but to give him credit, he has really applied himself so well since that. And, you know, again, drawing parallels with Nick Kyrgios, you know, he that time away from the sport, while no one would condone his actions of taking cocaine and whatever and getting banned for that, but it did give him a chance to really see what he was missing and understand, get a real perspective on how good his life is, you know, how fortunate he is to be this kind of top level tennis player. And it does seem to have instilled this great drive into Dan Evans to be the player that I think most of us who've watched tennis for a long time know he could be. You know, he is such a phenomenally talented player. He reads the game so well. He's not the tallest, but his hands are fantastic, and his, you know, his read of the game is just superb. So there's a lot of positives to take from him, and I think his coaching decision is more, right, who can I get to take me to the top level? How high can I go now? How hard can I be pushed? Who can really challenge me? So in many ways, if you feel you're not getting the most out of you right then, that even if it seems like it's going well from the outside to us, he knows better than any of us, I suppose, in many ways, what direction he should be going. For Kyle Edmund, it's just been a disaster this year, hasn't it? I mean, I can't really think of a single positive of Kyle Edmund's season. And there aren't many players I would say that about, but it's been pretty rough. And I know there's been knee problems. I know he's physically not always been right, but, you know, I don't know about you guys, but he just doesn't look that happy to be out there to me. Mm-hmm. He doesn't look like he's enjoying tennis. And every time we ask him, are you kind of enjoying it? He's like, yeah, I'm loving it. And it's like, are you really? I mean, he's on another kind of 5-match losing streak. A lot of these guys, you know, Zhizhong Zhang, I think was his name, who he lost to last time out. You know, he did play some good stuff, to be fair to Zhang, but that's a loss to the world number 212. Would Kyle have 14, 15 months ago be losing that match? I don't think so. I think he'd be taking that match under his wing and really kind of dominating it from the start. And it just, I don't know, it's just hard to know. So obviously he's split with Mark Hilton now, but I personally have always said I thought the bigger problem was replacing, you know, the coach he lost at the end of last year, you know, that kind of extra voice in there. So it's just, it's not going particularly well for him. And I think Dan is likely to pass him this week, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. I think he's got quarterfinals points dropping off Kyle. So unless he miraculously turns things around, I think we'll have a new British number one this week, which great achievement for Dan as well. You know, I was going back looking through how many British number ones there have actually been. It's not that many. Guys do tend to just sit there for a long time. So great credit to him. And it'll be interesting to see whether he can keep that spot next year with hopefully Andy Murray making his own return and stating his own case for it.
Yeah, my thoughts on Kyle, I just think he's lost his identity. I think he's lost what type of player he actually is. And, you know, I think Kyle Edmunds always had his most dangerous when he was playing attacking tennis, not worrying about looking for consistency. Mm. And I think he's almost caught up into the trap of actually wanting to be consistent week in, week out. But that takes away the real dangers that he has and where he makes life difficult for his opponents. You know, think of Australia. It's not about Kyle doing it 5 weeks in a row. It's about when he clicks for that 1 week, then he can be very, very dangerous. And I think he needs to get back to that, because the hardest part now, guys, is he's got no confidence. So it's difficult to go out there and say, Kyle, you've got to be aggressive. You've got to look to hit the forehand as hard as you can. And if you miss a few, so be it, when you've lost five matches in a row.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And I think Kyle, when he's at his best for me, is when he's hitting that serve and then smashing that forehand home. You know, he's that kind of big, powerful, weighty forehand straight after the serve, that kind of quick strike tennis that really sets him apart. And I think you're right that for me, the forehand doesn't look like it's doing anywhere near as much damage as it should be. I don't know if that's him playing more percentage tennis or whatever, but I think you're right. I think a confident Kyle Edmund would be more willing to rip that. And there were times against Zhang where he started to look like he was building a bit of confidence in that second set, like he could launch a comeback. But ultimately, every time he gets into a big moment of the minute, he's losing the big points. And that is a pretty worrying trend going forward. And he's got still a lot of points to defend at the end of this season. I think he could even find himself outside the top 70, which would be a pretty alarming slump.
So to Shanghai, Edmund, ironically, has got Jeremy Shardy as his first hurdle. Shardy, the guy who beat Dan Evans in the final round of qualies. That's for the right to take on Sasha Zverev, who we saw losing to Tsitsipas at the China Open. Baza, other matches that you might sort of really pick out or what you're expecting from Shanghai this coming week?
Well, Djokovic would be the big favourite. I expect Djokovic to continue the level he played in Tokyo. And I think the opportunity knocks, doesn't it, for loads of the other players. I think the race, obviously, is starting to really take shape. You've got five players that now have qualified with team the latest. So they're guaranteed. Tsitsipas will join them at some stage. He's more or less nailed on certainty. So then there's two places up for grabs. So your Bautista Agutz, your Zverev. I think Zverev will make it. Goffin played very well in Tokyo. Berrettini's come to the fore, although I don't think he will make it. And then you've got some of the other players that will hope that they can make a case. Paris is always the interesting one, isn't it? You never forget Sock a couple of years ago when he started the week at 23rd or 24th in the race, and then won the tournament, and then ends up making the top eight. So anyone that does play well the last couple of weeks can certainly make a late push.
And for you, George, on Metro UK, how big a deal is a Masters event at this stage of the year? I would imagine it's pretty huge.
Yeah, I think there's always interest in these Masters. I think, you know, with the big thing for the end of the year for me is that this kind of Djokovic-Nadal race, and I mean that on top of kind of Murray coming back, but I think that has the potential to have a lot of ebbs and flows, twists and turns. I think Djokovic is my favourite to finish the year as world number one. I think just at this time of the year, as we kind of alluded to earlier, that he can just be completely unstoppable. At this time, the conditions suit him and whatever. And Nadal not playing Shanghai, I think it's a big blow to him. Even if he could have just picked up, you know, quarterfinals or semis points here, that might prove to be the difference ultimately. But the race is pretty interesting. I'm with you. I think Zverev will make it. I think that will be the seven. And then the other one's pretty interesting. I mean, we look at last year, Karen Khachanov winning in Paris. You know, if he did that again, he could maybe even make the jump. I don't necessarily see that, but that's the kind of outlier you have to kind of watch out for at this time of year. But if I were a betting man, I would probably put Zverev in the seventh spot. And then I might go someone rogue, like a Fognini or someone a little bit on the outside.
That's very rogue, George.
That's very rogue. I'm going rogue. Why not? It's this time of the year. Crazy things happen.
They do indeed. Well, look, thank you so much for giving us all your time this evening to have a chat with us on the podcast. And we'll let you get underway with your coverage of Shanghai. And Baz, you and I'll be back this time next week, thereabouts, to look back on the penultimate Masters of the year. Guys, thank you very much. And thanks to everybody for listening in. Bye for now.